In the coming week, Sri Lankan lawmakers pick a new president amid a state of emergency. Russian forces take a so-called operational pause in Ukraine. And the UK's Farnborough Airshow returns with a glimpse of aviation's future. It's July 14th and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, I'd like to kick off by discussing a situation that has been percolating for a while and really has erupted recently. That is the political chaos in Sri Lanka. Thousands of protesters have now taken to the street. We've seen coverage of them in video footage. It's in the cover of today's Washington Post. Some of them have stormed the president's home in Colombo. Lawmakers are going to pick a new president, I believe, on July 20th. So, Jim, what's caused this outrage?
Economic mismanagement, Bob. The Sri Lankan economy is in dire straits with widespread food and fuel shortages. Many people have seen video of Sri Lankans lined up waiting for days to buy essentials like cooking gas, rice, milk, and medicine. Now, an economic crisis like this doesn't happen overnight. It's been building for years. Sri Lanka took on a lot of debt for big infrastructure projects of dubious value. The Sri Lankans financed that debt in part with hard currency they earn from tourism. Sri Lanka is a lovely country, but the 2019 Easter Sunday bombings that were carried out by Islamic suicide bombers that targeted luxury hotels in Sri Lanka hurt tourism. Then came COVID-19. Throw in remarkably ill-conceived tax cuts that greatly depleted government revenue, and suddenly Sri Lanka found itself unable to service its debt payments. The government took a number of steps to try to preserve hard currency so that it could pay back what it had borrowed. Those steps included last year's decision to ban the import of chemical fertilizers and herbicides used in farming. They just made matters worse. In the case of the ban on imports of fertilizer and herbicides, what they led to were much lower crop yields, which compounded the economic problems. Now, the blame for all of this falls rightly on the shoulders of Sri Lanka's president, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, who's been in office since 2019. Now, his family has dominated Sri Lankan politics over the last quarter of a century or so. They've come to power in good part by riling up and benefiting from Buddhist nationalism among the Sinhalese, who make up about 75% of Sri Lanka's population of 24 million people. Gotabaya's older brother, Mahinda, was a two-term president until he resigned in May because of protests as the country's prime minister. So that gives you a sense of how much this one family has dominated Sri Lankan politics. Again, as you mentioned, this past Saturday, protesters overran the presidential offices along with the official residences of both the president and prime minister. This led Gotabaya to promise to resign as president of Sri Lanka. In the meantime, he fled the country, went to the Maldives. Now he is in Singapore at last account. He had promised to resign by yesterday. Yesterday came and passed. No official resignation. Word is now, just as we're sitting down, that he has emailed his resignation back to Colombo. I'm not an expert on resignations under Sri Lankan law, so I don't know exactly how that plays out, whether it's official or not. But clearly, Sri Lanka is looking at having to pick a new leader. That is going to be, I think, fairly heavily disputed because Rajapaksa's party dominates in the Sri Lankan parliament. So we'll see whether they try to rally around someone who will look to protect the legacy of the Rajapaksas, or whether they fracture and ally with the other parties in the parliament. What is clear, Bob, is that whoever becomes the next president of Sri Lanka, and under the Sri Lankan system, the president exercises tremendous powers, even though there also is a prime minister, but they're going to have to get this economy back on track. That's going to be difficult to do. It's going to require negotiations with the World Bank and the IMF about relief for the situation they currently find themselves in. A big stumbling block there is going to be over what to do about the debt, how to reschedule it, the reluctance on the part of some of the countries who have loaned money to renegotiate the terms of the debt. but also real concerns about the lack of transparency about the debt that Sri Lanka accumulated in dealing with China. And there have been a lot of allegations that this money has gone into people's pockets rather than to active projects. The Chinese are very reluctant, not just in Sri Lanka, but elsewhere as part of their Belt and Road Initiative, to engage in sort of standard transparency about what the terms are of debt and who's getting which tranches of money.
Jim, so a lot at stake, obviously, with these elections. And I was going to follow up on that and just say, you know, do we have any sense of what the prospects are for a real leadership change? For example, does the country pick a group of technocrats who can kind of navigate through this real thicket and get them on some sort of a basis where they can kind of work their way out of this debt morass? Or is the dynastic politics so entrenched that we're looking at another cycle for Sri Lanka of crisis and chaos?
The short answer, Bob, is I don't know. And I don't think the Sri Lankans know what is going to happen next. Sri Lanka is entering uncharted territory. And a lot is going to depend upon what happens within the party that the Rajapaksas dominated. Does that party, which again controls a majority of the seats in parliament, sort of close ranks and try to protect the legacy of the Rajapaksas? And again, there's this issue of to what extent there has been official government corruption, and does that extend to members of this party? So again, one possibility is closing ranks and coming up with someone who may be unpopular, but nonetheless has sufficient support in parliament. Or do you see the party fracture and then have different alliances form? Then, of course, there's always the possibility that you may have a movement by the armed forces to take over and try to impose stability. You can never rule out in any situation as chaotic as this that you end up not following the rules, but you go in a non-democratic fashion. Plenty of examples of this across history.
Taking a step back on the bigger picture here, there's been a number of pieces starting to emerge about how Sri Lanka might be the beginning of a number of countries that are, you know, take your pick, poorly managed, weak, frail, what have you, that the crisis caused by the invasion of Ukraine has just thrust them into a situation beyond their control. Is there any sense of a kind of a IMF, World Bank emergency fire hose that could be directed towards a place like Sri Lanka? Or is it still too early to even, you know, sort of map that out?
Well, let's be clear here that the Sri Lankan economic crisis that has now become a political crisis is not fundamentally because of what has happened in Ukraine. That has certainly made matters worse, but this is a crisis that has been building for years. It involves a tremendous amount of mismanagement on the part of the Sri Lankan government. And I think as you look elsewhere around the world, the same thing holds true. The countries that are going to be hurt the most by what has happened in Ukraine are countries that already have lots of problems, maybe of their own making, maybe not. And what's happening in Ukraine will make it worse, particularly with issues of whether or not we're going to be able to get food that would normally come out of Russia and Ukraine onto the world market. Now, on that score, there's been some optimism in recent days that there are negotiations ongoing. Perhaps we will find a way to unlock some of those food shipments so they can come out. So that would tend to alleviate the crisis that we're potentially facing. But again, as you look around the world, the countries that have a lot of debt and don't have the ability to service it are in a difficult position, which the Ukraine crisis, for a variety of reasons, has made worse. Likewise, has been made worse by the fact that you have inflation in much of the West, and now you see central banks, particularly the Fed, taking steps to rein in inflation, raising interest rates. Those have all kinds of ripple effects which actually aggravate the situation, particularly of countries that have a lot of debt on hand.
Got it. So let's stay in the Ukraine theater then, Jim, if we can, and talk about some interesting developments there, potentially interesting developments. You mentioned the food discussions going on. Analysts are calling what's happening at the moment an operational pause by Russia, although you're still getting reports of rockets being fired in various areas, including discriminately or indiscriminately attack on civilian centers and apartment buildings and such. But let's just say there is some sort of a pause in effect. Why would Russia take a pause at this point?
two things here, Bob. First, a pause does not mean fighting is ending or is over or is ceasefire. That's not what's being discussed. Okay. Indeed, just before we sat down to tape this podcast, I saw a news flash that a Russian missile had just hit a city in Ukraine southwest of Kyiv. This is way away from where most of the fighting is taking place now on the ground in the Donbas in Donetsk and Luhansk. So it is not the case that we are talking about a ceasefire or a truce, which is one of the reasons why the Ukrainian government does not like the media using this phrase, operational pause. What the operational pause really refers to, and this is really the second point, is that the Russians are slowing down the rate of their attacks in the eastern portion of Ukraine. And this largely seems to be an effort on the part of the Russians to allow their troops to operate a lower operational tempo because the fighting has been so intense on the front. I had an opportunity on the president's inbox to sit down with Michael Kaufman, as one of the leading experts on the war that's being played out in Ukraine. We went through the various challenges that the Russian and Ukrainian militaries are facing in trying to fight very heavy artillery-oriented war in the Donbas and the challenges that face. So really, this is for the Russians an opportunity to, in essence, rest or give their troops a bit more rest. It doesn't mean that the fighting is over. The expectation is that the fighting will resume in intensity and is going to continue. And that's why we have a lot of talk about the war in Ukraine. It's not something that's going to end next month, but could go on for quite a long time. Talk about the long war. I think NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg even said it could go on for years. So this is more a lull rather than an end to the fighting.
Yeah, I would just note for our listeners that President's Inbox episode just aired this week. Michael Kaufman does walk through in a very interesting way sort of the weaknesses and the strengths of both sides and indicating just how long or just how much that could feed into a much longer war, a war that is already considered one of the longer ones in recent memory, land wars at least. But Jim, I was wondering then, are we seeing any movement on the easing some of these other stresses that you were referencing on the Sri Lanka segment of this show, which is then there is Russian willingness seemingly to sit down and talk about loosening up its blockade on the massive grain shipments that are stuck in ports in the Black Sea, for example. But while at the same time, seemingly no Russian appetite for discussing any other aspects of sort of calming the war's impact.
Well, we'll certainly see whether those negotiations lead to anything. There have been several points over the last several months where we've seen talk of possible breakthroughs that never really materialized. I mean, I think you have to look at what is happening in Ukraine and operate on the premise that it is going to continue for quite a long time. The Russians have given no indication that they are prepared to negotiate. The attitude from the Kremlin seems to be that we are winning and we expect to continue winning. In some sense, Putin's bet is that the Russians can keep up the fight longer than the West is willing to tolerate the costs associated with supporting Ukraine, and then eventually Ukraine will have to give up. Now, the counter to it, I think the Ukrainian perspective is that the Russians can't keep up the level of fighting they are currently pursuing, and that there will be opportunities in the future for Ukrainian forces to engage in counteroffensive that will be able to push back the Russians. And that possibility becomes more likely the more weapons, materiel that the West is able to give to Ukraine. Now, of course, the big question here is whether or not Ukraine has sufficient number of trained military personnel to make this strategy work. The casualty rate the Ukrainians are taking in the Donbas have been very high. And the challenge you have is even if you can get people to go to the front, the question is, do you have enough people who are well trained to go to the front? And then when you add in the question of you want people in your military to operate weapon systems that they haven't been trained on, how long is it going to take them to learn how to operate those systems properly and effectively? So, for example, there's been a lot of talk about the United States providing the Ukrainians with this weapon system known as HIMARS. It's a high volume artillery, and the rockets that are fired are guided by satellites, and they're very accurate. And I think we have 9 battalions of HIMARS in Ukraine, and the goal is to get to 16. And there have been calls for the United States to provide as many as 60. But the challenge here is that it takes time for anyone to learn how to operate this system and operate it properly. Again, some weapon systems you can be trained in a couple of hours. I've heard it suggested that the javelins, which you heard a lot about at the beginning of the war in terms of anti-tank warfare, are weapons that you could learn to use properly in maybe a day's worth of training, whereas HIMARS, it may take several weeks. So that's going to be the challenge as this materiel flows into the theater, is making sure you can, A, get it there. That's a logistical challenge in and of itself, but having people who actually know how to use it properly. So this is going to be a big challenge going forward. Lots of stories, obviously, about crunches in terms of ammunition on both sides. Most governments don't stock up in preparation of fighting wars like this. Again, this is one of the downsides, the sort of lack of investment by Western militaries in weapons over the last 20 or 30 years or so.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I've also seen increasing reporting about the use of drones, where to date, Ukraine seems to have been more effective at using drones. It certainly has benefited from these drones that Turkey has provided, which are of the same type that have won the day for Azerbaijan in its recent war with Armenia. But Russia's now into apparently serious talks with Iran over acquiring drones, which Iran has become fairly efficient at creating as well. So you could end up seeing these expanded field of markets, let's say, of what countries are willing to provide materiel. And you have this Ukraine theater as this place where all sorts of things are being tried out.
Well, that's certainly the case, Bob. And there are plenty of historical examples of that. The one that jumps to mind most immediately for me is the Spanish Civil War back in the 1930s, where the Germans used it as an opportunity to test out new kinds of weapons and tactics. And I think there's going to be a lot of attention paid to the performance of these Iranian drones, assuming that they actually show up. How well do they perform and the like? But again, this gets back to the bigger question. You have a war, essentially, of attrition ongoing in Ukraine. And a war of attrition will grind on as long as both sides have sufficient armaments to be able to prosecute it. And big question is that going to continue to be the case? The Russians, obviously, much larger country than Ukraine, 100 million more people, presumably has the capacity to produce its own ammunition, though obviously that takes time. You have all kinds of potential bottlenecks, particularly when you talk about more sophisticated weapons. The Ukrainians clearly relying on supply from the United States and NATO countries. But again, do you see other countries providing the Russians with technology? Is Iran a one-off? Do you see the Chinese begin to provide the Russians with weapons? To the best of my understanding, that hasn't happened yet. There are lots of reasons why the Chinese may decide it's not in their interest to do so. But again, governments can change their mind when they believe their interests are being threatened. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. But the big message here is, again, that this war is likely to grind on, and that is going to lead to a lot of death and destruction for the Ukrainian people. But it's also going to have big ripple effects. And I think the sense people had back in February that this was a war that would be over quickly or come to an end, or we could negotiate a settlement, none of that looks to be happening. This is going to grind on, and the question is going to be whether there's the will and the capacity to maintain that. And I suspect you're going to be hearing more calls as we get into the fall about the wisdom of pursuing the war, calls in the West for finding ways to negotiate a settlement with the Russians. My sense is, from what I hear from Russians and Russian outlets, is that's what they're counting on. And that's why they're optimistic that they're going to prevail in the end. We'll see if that turns out to be the case.
And back to your original point, it's an operational pause, but only just that. And we're going to be in this for quite some time.
Yes, I think that's a fair summary, Bob. Let's pivot, Bob, move away from war, and let's talk about aviation broadly. On Monday, the Farnborough Air Show will take place outside of London. The 2022 show is going to focus on innovative fields such as commercial space travel, sustainable or climate conscious flights, and of course, military operations. What can folks expect to take away from this upcoming air show?
Well, there's a little bit of a connection with our previous discussion, Jim, in that there's going to be certainly some demonstrations of the prowess of military, you know, air vehicles, whether it's drones that are operated automatically or whether it is some of the new line of helicopters, military attack helicopters and so forth. We're seeing all sorts of reports from big manufacturers like Boeing talking about their whole lineup of equipment that could be used in defense capacity. It's worth noting that what Farnborough is, first of all, it's taking place for the first time in 4 years. It alternates with the Paris Air Show as one of the biggest of their kind each year, but it had been suspended under the pandemic like so many other major shows. So it's back, and it's back in a big way. And its previous Farnborough, which was born in the years after World War II, has been a place where such hallowed craft like the supersonic Concorde or more recently the Eurofighter debuted. And so it is a place where big splashes can take place. Certainly big business can take place. This year, something like 70 or so aircraft are due to be reviewed and previewed. A lot of the reporting is indicating a kind of reining in of some of the more daring shows that are part of this air show. So typically air shows will show sort of vehicles showing off what they can do. There have been a few famous incidents in previous years at other air shows where there's a mishap and there's a crash and there are deaths and injuries and so forth. So I think there's a reining in of that, but there's still very much an emphasis on the new and the experimental. I mentioned Boeing. One of the things that Boeing is going to be showing off is the 777X plane, which is being billed as, quote, the most sustainable twin-engine aircraft the world has ever seen, end quote. We'll have to see if that's true. But sustainable is this new concept, this new buzz phrase that you're hearing more and more. It's basically the use or the blending of biofuels alongside regular fuels so that you are reducing the amount of CO2 emissions. Aircraft are well known to be among the largest contributors to carbon emissions at a time of heightened concern about climate change caused by human activity. The air business is trying to get into this in some extent. So there's that. There's also a lot more buzzing about decarbonization strategies coming from Boeing and other makers. Boeing has a joint venture called the Whisk Aero, which is a all-electric vertical takeoff landing air taxi. So that's going to be showed at Farnborough. And we'll have to see whether, you know, air taxis, we start seeing more of that type of craft coming forward. So it's an opportunity to definitely delve into commercial innovation with an ear towards what's happening globally, what's happening in the terms of climate. And then also defense in the backdrop of one of the biggest land wars in Europe since the Second World War. What are the relevant sort of defense capabilities that are being demonstrated? Some of the stats in the event already indicate that there's going to be a lot of business being conducted here. An estimated $192 billion in deals might be sealed at this, compares to just $67 billion in deals at the 2016 air show. So there's a lot of activity, maybe pent-up interest and deal-making. And Farnborough is, again, going to be something that kind of appears on people's radar, pardon the expression, for a while. Not to mention all the space, commercialization of space that you mentioned in the outset, Jim.
Bob, getting back to the issue of sustainability in aviation going forward, and I guess planes account for roughly 2.1% of annual CO2 emissions. Do you think this represents a real move toward better technology, or is this more about companies trying to brand themselves as being environmentally friendly to ward off sort of attacks from people who want to call air travel into question?
Yeah, you can't get away from the latter point, Jim, which is the term you hear a lot is greenwashing, where there's companies try to come up and make a big fuss about what they're doing in the environmental sustainability aspect. And again, an air show taking place in the middle of a summer where we've already seen epic heat. I think the UK itself is going through a heat wave at this moment. Certainly the Southwest United States, parts of Asia have experienced intense heat. It's more and more foremost on people's minds, on planners' minds. Is it a bit of PR or is it something that's real? I think that for me, that's what makes Farnborough especially interesting this year, is whether that in fact is what we're looking at. Because again, if you look at, you know, that there's this keen desire, I think, on many parts to try to make air travel much more of a sustainable thing, whether it's burning, you know, biofuels or electric vehicles playing a bigger role. But, you know, when you talk about space travel and things like that, I'm not sure that anybody has come up with a formula for flight that does not involve intense burning of fossil fuels still to create the kind of power that's needed. I think we got to be realistic about it, but it is also going to be very interesting to see whether the types of deal making that goes on includes, you know, these types of vehicles, these next generation vehicles that could start to be played out. Maybe you have a sort of a mid-sized country that has the ability to sort of plan out in this fashion, and they decide to purchase a number of, let's say, air taxis that are all electric, and suddenly you start seeing copycats, and maybe that can take hold, Jim. So I think there's potential, but I think we also have to be realistic that sometimes it's there's an aspiration to try to show that you're doing the right thing, and it might be overblown because we just have to see on balance what we're talking about here. And certainly, I think a lot of the military fighter planes and other things are, you know, we're talking about still planes with incredible technical capabilities, but that are also contributing to emissions.
I will note, Bob, that we are talking about the future of aviation, and there are a lot of people listening to us chat who would like to see the airlines get existing aviation travel fixed. We're in the midst of one of the most difficult travel seasons in memory. Things have been bad across the globe in terms of mishaps and canceled flights. I will note that London's Heathrow, a place I was just at recently, has just imposed a cap on the number of passengers who are allowed to travel through it because of a shortage of baggage handlers, people to operate security lines, flight attendants, pilots. It's basically been a very hard reboot from the COVID years.
That's a really good point in that all this talk about tech and the future of aviation, it's still an industry. Certainly the passenger flight industry is still obviously runs on the ability of trained and skilled labor. And those things you're citing, Jim, I think are phenomena seen worldwide, that the double whammy of the pandemic and then that slowing down, drastically slowing down flight and borders closing and so forth. And then all of a sudden, this eruption of interest in travel again, it is simply not able to keep up and not able to staff all these essential areas that I think people took for granted pre-2020. And now it takes time to ramp that back up. That's kind of the more mundane, less sort of glamorous side of the industry, but we're not going to probably see it at Farnborough, but it is worth noting and it's worth thinking about. Certainly, there's got to be a better way to deal with the ebb and flow of the industry than like mass furloughs and then trying to ramp back up again.
Certainly, Bob, and I'm struck that you mentioned the word glamour because there used to be a time when flying was considered to be glamorous. I'm actually old enough to remember when people got dressed up when they were going to fly. Maybe they're only going from Boston to New York, but you put on your finest to get on a plane. Based on my most recent travels, I would say very few people look at air travel as a glamorous activity and a time to, you know, wear your finest.
No, it is sad how far it's fallen, actually, and how much of a drudgery and a sort of a grim exercise it's become. And the world you hearken to, I think people haven't seen it, the movie Catch Me If You Can, which came out about 20 or so years ago, does a great job of kind of capturing that moment in Pan Am and sort of all the glamour involved in being a flight attendant and so forth.
Yes, those are the glamorous days. Anyway, it's time now for us to pivot and discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on our tweet as at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected new Webb telescope images. Now, I know this topic is in your wheelhouse, Bob. Why is Webb telescope images the audience figure of the week?
Well, Jim, yes, listeners to this podcast know that we go over the moon, pardon the expression, on anything involving space and space exploration. And we had quite a week this week. I think it's hard to find anybody who wasn't affected by what emerged from a release at NASA news conference earlier this week. And what was that? NASA released 5 images from the James Webb Space Telescope, which is in solar orbit, something like 1 million miles away, and is starting to create images. And these are not just sort of old school photographic images or images of the like that the Hubble has been creating since 1990. These are infrared. These are able to go much farther and much deeper. And they are something to behold. It is sort of gasp-worthy so far what we've seen. It includes this collection of galaxies known as SMACS 0723. That doesn't do it justice. It's this amazing sort of splash of color and galactic wonder, just showing this collection of galaxies. So each one of the lights, or many of the lights depicted in this photograph, represent individual galaxies. Another photo is of the Carina Nebula. It's one of the largest and brightest nebula in the sky. It's about 7,600 light years from Earth. There is something known as WASP-96b, giant gas planet that's orbiting a star 1,150 light years from Earth. There's the Southern Ring Nebula, which is an expanding cloud of gas that's about half a light year wide. It's surrounding a dying star 2,000 light years away. I'm using terms that are a bit abstract on purpose, because part of what is going on with these photographs is that they're showing a bit of the past. They are capturing light that has faded since it was generated, but it's still giving astronomers, it's giving a whole host of people a glimpse into the earliest origins of the universe. The fifth one I should mention is called Stefan's Quintet, which is a group of galaxies that was first conjectured to exist almost 200 years ago. It is very far away from Earth. It's about 290 million light years away. But all of this is giving astronomers, again, as I said, an opportunity to study the universe, to kind of fill in the blanks in some cases. One of the things that's going to get a lot of study is what are known as exoplanets. These are planets that orbit other stars, and what their atmospheres are made of. One of the hopes is that scientists might find planets with life. There were some indications in the photos that an exoplanet had water in its atmosphere. Already they've been able to determine that. So where there's water, there's potential for life. So it's just taken everything just exponentially farther than the Hubble did. And recall, when the Hubble first started sending photos back, people were gasping at those. I still remember the first clutch of Hubble photos and, you know, the kind of stuff that people would put posters on their wall. Of course, I also remember the first major color photo of planet Earth taken from some of the moon missions in the late 1960s. So it's all gotten quite further developed in the last 50 years or so, Jim.
It certainly is, Bob. Though I have to say, when I saw the photo of the Carina Nebula, it actually reminded me of artwork I've seen on a number of science fiction books. So we're now having science catching up with where artists have been for some time.
No, that's a great way of putting it, Jim. It's a cross between science fiction art and, you know, non-fungible tokens in some ways. So it's quite a mashup. But I think, again, this was just the first, and it's just, you know, it's just sort of firing up into action. So it's going to be sort of fascinating to see what the web is able to create. And by the way, rightly so, the Biden administration and the partners that were involved in putting this together, you know, have a lot to be proud of in just what it took to set up this telescope. Yes, it was late. Yes, it was over budget. But now it's orbiting out there. It's got a sun shield, something like the size of a tennis court, that's protecting it and allowing it to do its work. So I think it's just it was a rare opportunity for a lot of people to coalesce around technical achievement.
Government sometimes works. But I have to ask you, Bob, you mentioned non-fungible tokens. This telescope cost a lot of money to build and put up into space. Any interest by NASA in translating these photos into non-fungible tokens and making a killing on the crypto market or whatever these markets are?
Well, now that you mention it, they should, actually. I would imagine there is a whole side of the NASA enterprise that might be thinking along the lines of distributing this art, since it is so impressive and there are so many people who are, I think, have been captivated by it, whether it's NFTs or whether it's some sort of other depictions that people want to buy digitally or hard copies. I think there's a lot of merchandising capability there for NASA, Jim.
Okay, but I think I'm going to save my money to pay for Netflix.
I'm just waiting for the next cluster of galaxies to see if they can wow me even more, Jim. And by the way, Joni Mitchell was right. We are stardust, Jim. So we're just looking at our own past.
Well, I will say one takeaway from looking at these photos is that we really are a speck in a very large universe.
You know, and talking through the other issues in this podcast, it does put in perspective just sort of where our little developments rank. So, yes.
Certainly does.
And that's our look at the world and outer world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. France's President Emmanuel Macron meets UAE leader Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. North Macedonia's parliament debates negotiations that could lead to a long-awaited EU membership, and the January 6th committee will hold its next public meeting in primetime.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. We love to get feedback. The articles, books, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Rafaela Seward, with senior podcast producer Gabrielle Sierra. Marcus Zacharia engineered this episode. Thank you, Marcus. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch, Morme Zanke, and John David Cobb. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long, and be careful out there.